In the grim darkness of the 41st millennium, war is eternal. Yet even amid the endless carnage, there are names that cast a longer shadow of terror than others. One such name is spoken in hushed, fearful whispers across the beleaguered worlds of the Sabbat sector, the Blood Pact. To the ordinary citizens of the Imperium, the Blood Pact is a byword for nightmare given flesh. A regiment of traitors whose brutality is matched only by their chilling discipline. They are not mere rabble of chaos cultists flailing in mindless fury. They are something far more unsettling. They are soldiers, excellently trained, ruthlessly organized, and fanatically devoted, who have willingly bound themselves in blood and oath to an archon of chaos. And wherever they have marched, the very knowledge of their coming has sown dread like poison in the heart of armies and populations alike. What they conquer and tear down by force of arms is grievous enough, but worse is the dread that precedes them. In hive cities and frontier forts, tales spread of red-armored figures wearing grotesque iron visages, appearing out of the smoke and gloom with las rifles and bayonets slick with gore. These tales alone have caused panicked retreats and riots even before a shot is fired. An Imperial officer who faced them remarked bitterly that the damage done by fear of the Blood Pact can be as devastating as any bombardment. Such is the psychological weapon the Pact wields, terror as potent as artillery. To understand how the Blood Pact earned its dreaded reputation, one must travel back through bloody centuries to the very fringes of the Sabbat worlds. The exact genesis of the Blood Pact is lost to legend and distortion, but Imperial scholars believe its roots reach some 3,000 standard years into the past. It began on a distant planet called Kura, a world of primitive cruelty at the sector's edge. Kura, also pronounced as Gora in fragmentary sources, was a feral place where tribes warred constantly under the eye of Dark Gaul there, a feudal overlord known by the title of Gore, a word in the local tongue meaning something akin to warlord or supreme chief, held dominion. This Gaur was no mere chieftain, but a tyrant who demanded absolute fealty and tribute to his patron deity, the blood god Khorne. At Kura's crude courts, the Gaur surrounded himself with a coterie of priests who practiced bloody rituals. Skulls piled in towering cairns, and altars ran slick with sacrificial blood in honor of Khorne, the chaos god of war and slaughter. These priests were fanatics, steeped in the creeds of chaos, yet they were also disciplined in their devotion. Over time, this militant priesthood began to take on another role beyond conducting sacrifices and intoning war prayers. They became the Gaur's protectors. Their martial training was as zealous as their liturgies, for they believed that guarding the warlord was a sacred duty, an extension of their worship. Thus was born an elite bodyguard on Gura, warrior priests whose blades were consecrated with the blood of offerings and whose loyalty was bound by both faith and personal oath. As the Gaur's influence grew and spread to neighboring worlds, it was this bodyguard force that led his conquering armies. It soon became a mark of respect to be blood-pacted to the Gaur. Numbers swelled as fierce warriors from subjugated tribes and vassal planets were added to the ranks. What began as a cadre of a few dozen zealots evolved into a host of hundreds, then thousands of sworn fighters drawn from every corner of the warlord's expanding domain. Each new recruit performed the same ritual of initiation, cutting his flesh and letting his blood flow over the jagged armor of his lord as both a personal bond and a sacrament to the blood god. Through this grisly practice, the warband earned its enduring name, the Blood Pact. Their very identity was rooted in that sanguinary bargain. Blood willingly given to the Gore and to Khorne in exchange for power and purpose. This early blood pact was unlike the ragged mobs of chaos cultists found elsewhere. Even at its inception, it was defined by order and loyalty. The original Qur'an bodyguards drilled ceaselessly with spear, blade, and crude firearm. They followed a strict code of obedience to their commanders. This martial discipline, guided by ruthless spiritual indoctrination, set them apart from other corn-worshipping hordes that often dissolved into frenzied anarchy. On Qura, the Blood Pact learned to channel the Blood God's fury with a soldier's focus. They would need that focus, for in time their fate would be tied to a much greater war that engulfed the stars themselves. Millennia passed, and the name and tradition of the Blood Pact endured in the shadows, flaring up wherever the descendants of Gaura's warriors went. But it was in the dying decades of the 41st millennium, during a conflict known as the Sabbat World's Crusade, that the Blood Pact truly burst onto the stage of galactic history. It was then that a man named Urlok Gor, inheritor of the ancient title of Gor, rose to infamy. Urlok Gor was a chaos warlord from the Sabbat World's region, a fierce but until then obscure champion of Khorne. He had inherited the secret of the Blood Pact and turned it into his greatest weapon. The Sabbat Worlds, a cluster of planets on the frontier of Imperial space, had fallen to chaos decades before the Crusade began. A powerful Archon, Overlord, named Nadzibar, had united various chaos factions and conquered the sector around the early 600 of 41st millennium. By the time the Imperium marshaled a great counteroffensive to reclaim these worlds, the crusade that began in 755 of 41st millennium, Nadzibar's forces were deeply entrenched. Urlok Gor was one of several magisters, warlord lieutenants, serving under Archon Nadzibar's dark banner. He was not the most brilliant strategist among them, nor the most charismatic leader. Those accolades belonged to others like the silver-tongued Nokud the Blighted or the infamous sorcerer Anaquanar Sek. But Gaur possessed one asset none of the others did, an army that was not a howling rabble, but a true disciplined fighting force. He had the Blood Pact. An army that was not a howling rabble, but a true disciplined fighting force. He had the Blood Pact. When the Imperial Crusade under Warmaster Slado struck into the Sabbat Worlds, they faced a plethora of chaos legions, mutant warbands, and heretic militias. Most were disorganized, relying on sheer fanatic numbers or the terror of summoned demons. They could win battles through savagery, but against the Imperial Guard's drilled regiments and the strategic genius of Warmaster Slado, they ultimately yielded ground. The turning point of the early crusade came in 765 of 41st millennium at Balhaut, a world where Slado personally slew Archon Nadzibar in the midst of a massive battle. Warmaster Slado himself was mortally wounded in that duel, but the death of Nadzibar threw the Chaos Command into disarray. In the chaotic aftermath, the Imperium glimpsed the first evidence of the Blood Pact's existence. Among the prisoners taken was a scarred, vicious woman who claimed allegiance not to the fallen Archon, but to a new master, Urlok Gor, whom she called the Gor. She boasted that she was sworn by blood to his service. This was a perplexing novelty to Imperial interrogators at the time, but it heralded a major shift in the war. With Nadzibar gone, a vicious struggle erupted among his surviving magisters and demagogues for supremacy over the Chaos armies. By rights, the position of Archon Overlord of the Sabbat, World's Chaos Host, should have fallen to one of the more renowned generals or cult leaders. Many warlords vied for it. The twisted genius S.E.K., the brutal Herator Asphodel, the fanatical Enoch Innocenti, and others of dark legend. Each commanded legions of traitors and monsters, but their forces, though massive, were fractious and prone to infighting. Urlok Gor was seen by some as a relatively unremarkable contender, a brute from the sector's fringe with fewer followers. Yet, when the slaughterous infighting subsided, it was Gaur who emerged wearing the mantle of Archon. His ascension was no fluke of chance. Urlok Gaur claimed the throne of the archenemy through the iron discipline and loyalty of the Blood Pact, while his rivals' hordes were tearing each other apart in an orgy of ambition and betrayal. Gaur's troops stayed tightly in line, moving with purpose and coordination. World by world, battle by battle, the Blood Pact cut down any who refused to acknowledge Gaur's leadership. The warbands that bent the knee to him were often absorbed into the Pact's ranks, made to swear the Blood Oath and adopt the Pact's strict martial code. Within a few short years following Balhaut, Urlok Gaur was acknowledged by friend and foe alike as Archon, the new warlord of the Sabbat worlds. He commanded not only the original core of the Blood Pact, but also countless devotees from other cults who had been folded into his growing army. Under Gaur's direction, the Blood Pact evolved from a mere personal guard into the very backbone of the archenemy's war effort in the Sabbat World's Crusade. For the Imperial High Command, the appearance of this new Archon and his Blood Pact was a grave development. Warmaster Slado's successor, the young and fiery Makaroth, suddenly found that the nature of the war had changed. No longer were Imperial Guard regiments facing only the expected mindless waves of Chaos fanatics, which, however terrifying, could often be broken by superior tactics and firepower. Now they faced regiments of Chaos soldiers who stood their ground with unholy discipline, who laid ambushes and crossfires as skillfully as any Imperial officer, and who willingly died to the last man rather than retreat an inch without orders. Wherever the Blood Pact marched, they stiffened the resolve of the lesser traitor mobs around them, imposing an order on Chaos that made the entire enemy front far more dangerous. Imperial tacticians came to grudgingly respect and fear this development. Accounts from the front lines began to refer to Blood Pact detachments as elite archenemy infantry, a term rarely used for the usually ragtag heretic rabble. The change was evident in the field. Gaur's forces now met the Imperial Guard on equal terms, and sometimes even outmaneuvered them. This recognition was aptly demonstrated at the Battle of the Akhorite Peninsula on Belshir Binary in 771 of 41st millennium. Belshir Binary was a vital industrial world, rife with promethium refineries that both sides desperately coveted. A modest imperial force of 3,000 guardsmen was tasked with securing a refinery complex on the Akhorite Peninsula, unaware that they walked into a trap. Lying in wait, perfectly camouflaged and unmoving for days in the scorching heat, were 200 blood-packed soldiers, accompanied by a handful of spidery Chaos war machines, known as Stalk Tanks, and two broods of the alien mercenaries called Lox-Atl. The blood-packed commander, later identified by intercepted Vox as one Vesh Etogaur, the second term indicating a rank akin to a colonel, had drilled his troops in absolute stealth and patience. For 72 straight hours they lay hidden, unseen by Imperial recon. Only once the Imperial contingent moved into the lethal cone of their ambush did the Pact spring the trap. What followed was less a battle and more a butchery. The Blood Pact erupted from concealment, catching the guardsmen in overlapping fields of fire, while their Stalk Tanks clambered forth on piston limbs to sow panic and confusion. In the space of 22 ruthless minutes, the entire Imperial force was annihilated to the last man. Not a single guardsman escaped the killing zone alive. The Promethium refinery fell firmly into Chaos hands, and would remain so for 15 months before the Imperium reclaimed that blood-soaked ground. The Akhorite Peninsula massacre was just one example, albeit a particularly stark one, of how the Blood Pact fought and why they were feared. After Belshir Binary, no Imperial commander would ever again underestimate a Chaos force simply because it wore the face of a cult. The Imperium realized that under Urlok Gaur, the archenemy had forged a new blade to wield against mankind. A host of soldiers that combined the zealotry of Chaos with the regimented efficiency of the Emperor's own armies. War Master Makaroth himself was heard to curse Gore's name, lamenting that the enemy now met the Imperial Guard on its own terms, and on dark days, even outfought them. What had begun as a hopeful crusade to liberate worlds from crazed heretic mobs was now turning into a grinding war against a foe as tactically formidable as any loyalist force, yet driven by a vile faith that sanctioned every atrocity. Central to the Blood Pact's battlefield effectiveness was its strict organization and hierarchy. Urlok Gaur shaped his legions in the image of the very Imperial Guard he sought to destroy, a deliberate irony, using the hated Imperium's own structure as a weapon against it. At the broadest level, the Blood Pact functioned as a true army, with defined units, logistics, and a clear chain of command. They were not a disparate alliance of warbands, each doing as they pleased. Gaur's word was absolute law to all who had sworn the pact, and through a rigid command structure, his orders could ripple down to the lowest trench fighter with speed and clarity unheard of among typical Chaos followers. The pact's internal ranks did not mimic Imperial titles, but had their own nomenclature rooted in the old traditions of Gura, often incorporating the revered syllable Gaur. For instance, a general or high commander in the Blood Pact was known as an Ito Gaur, a title that implied the bearer was a chosen warlord under the Archon's aegis. Imperial tacticians equate an Ito Gaur roughly to the rank of a colonel or general officer. Officers of slightly lesser stature carried titles such as Damogor, comparable to a major, and Sirdar, a lieutenant equivalent. In Blood Pact culture, the rank title is placed after the name. For example, a warrior named Mabbon, holding the rank of Etogaur, would be addressed as Mabbon Etogaur. This use of Gaur in their ranks was a constant reminder of their service to the Archon. As one rose in rank, one carried more of Gaur's name as an honorific, symbolizing closeness to the warlord's power. Commands were enforced by a brutal system of discipline. Unlike the Imperium, which employs commissars to stiffen morale through fear, the Blood Pact's creed normally forbade members from spilling the blood of their own brethren. All blood was to be shed for the Blood God and against the enemy, not wasted in internal squabbles. This principle helped keep them unified where other heretic groups might descend into infighting. However, recognizing that absolute obedience sometimes needed an iron hand, Gaur sanctioned a special cadre of enforcers called Arnogors. These individuals were given the sacred authority to execute any Blood Pact member, regardless of rank, who faltered or disobeyed orders. In effect, they were Chaos's dark mirror to the Commissariat. Every trooper knew that a failure on the battlefield would not only invite the wrath of Horn, but also a merciless end at the hands of an Arno Gaur. Fear was thus focused inward as well as outward. Blood Pact soldiers feared failing their masters almost as much as they relished slaughtering the enemy. This ensured that cowardice and dissent were all but extinguished within their ranks. Under Gaur's leadership, the Blood Pact also grew in number and diversity by absorbing other traitor forces wholesale. Many Imperial Guard units that had turned renegade, as well as planetary defense militias that fell to Chaos, were given a choice when encountering Gaur's armies: swear the Blood Oath and join the Pact's order, or be exterminated as unworthy. Those who submitted were made to carve the ritual scars into their hands and were indoctrinated into the Pact's ways. Their military training and specialties were then co-opted for Chaos. In this manner, Gar cleverly integrated the talents of professional soldiers who had betrayed the Emperor, spreading these seasoned turncoats throughout his regiments to share their expertise. Such converts were watched carefully by veteran loyalists of the Pact. Some long-serving blood-pacted warriors harbored deep suspicion towards those who once served the Imperium, but those traitors who proved their zeal for Khorne quickly rose as officers and drill masters, elevating the combat prowess of the Pact as a whole. Not only humans filled the Blood Pact's ranks, Gore was nothing if not pragmatic in his pursuit of victory. The Blood Pact became infamous for enlisting the aid of dreaded Xeno's mercenaries and warped creatures that most Imperial commanders would never expect to find fighting alongside human heretics. Chief among these were the loxatal, sinuous, crocodilian aliens who slithered low to the ground and wielded bizarre, flesh-chewing flechette blasters. These Xenos cared nothing for Chaos ideology, but they were remorseless killers for hire, and the Pact paid them in plunder, and presumably flesh, to bolster certain operations. The sight of inhuman loxatal hunters stalking beside blood-packed infantry added a terrifying extra dimension to many battlefields, challenging the Imperial assumption that aliens and Chaos worshippers rarely cooperate. Under Gar's blood-soaked banner, common cause was found in the simple joy of slaughtering the Emperor's servants. In addition to alien mercenaries, the Blood Pact readily employed mutants, Chaos-spawned beasts, and even the occasional Chaos Space Marine warband within their battle order. No traitor Astartes would formally consider himself part of the Blood Pact's hierarchy. Their pride and loyalties lie with their own fallen legions or warbands. Yet on multiple occasions, bands of Khorne-worshipping Chaos Marines fought alongside the Pact in major engagements. Superhuman berserkers from the World Eaters Legion, for instance, might be unleashed at the vanguard of a Pact assault to shatter an Imperial defensive line in an orgy of close-quarters butchery, with the disciplined Blood Pact infantry following through the breach to secure the win. Gore harnessed these unpredictable allies as living weapons. He gave them free rein to indulge their bloodlust at the critical point of attack, then directed his own troops to exploit the carnage they wrought. The Pact also maintained its own armored columns and artillery batteries, often consisting of vehicles captured from the Imperium or manufactured on seized forge worlds like Urdesh and Nephithyl. By the height of the Crusade, Gaor's forces fielded tank regiments equipped with twisted versions of Imperial battle tanks, such as the AT-70 Reaver pattern medium tank, common on Chaos-held worlds, or even a few of the massive AT-83 Brigand heavy tanks and ancient Baneblade-class behemoths pressed into service of the Dark Gods. These tanks were daubed in red paint and decorated with trophies, flayed skins, severed heads, and profane cornate symbols, rumbling forward as icons of terror. Similarly, the Pact deployed artillery nicknamed Usurper Guns, repurposed from Imperial Basilisks and Medusas, which pounded loyalist lines with shells etched in blasphemous scripture. Uniquely, the Pact did not shy from using Psykers despite their Khorne worship, for Khorne, as the god of blood and battle, traditionally despises sorcery. They employed arcane specialists, known as Gore Mages Warp-touched witches, who could, by rituals of blood, instill berserker rages or summon forth demonic entities to possess willing hosts. In the fires of war, a Gore mage might perform a hideous rite to fuse a lesser daemon into the flesh of a blood-packed volunteer, transforming him into a frenzied monstrosity nicknamed a Blood Wolf. These possessed soldiers, slavering and howling with otherworldly fury, would hurl themselves at the enemy as near-unstoppable shock troops. Gore mages also projected an aura of fear that could unnerve and scatter enemy defenders, and they served as conduits for dark communications, sending psychic messages across battlefields or scrying the foe's movements in ways Imperial tacticians struggled to counter. Gore's readiness to use such methods, even at risk of offending Khorne's purest creed, spoke to his cold determination to win by any means necessary. Through all these elements, human discipline, traitor expertise, Xenos support, technological might, and occult fear-mongering, the Blood Pact became a truly formidable war machine. It was often said in grim tones by Imperial commanders that Gaur's army fought with the efficiency of the Emperor's own, but was driven by a fanaticism and cruelty that made it, in some ways, even more dangerous. The Blood Pact could undertake complex operations like synchronized orbital drops, or multi-pronged pincer attacks, or melt away into scattered guerrilla cells if facing superior force, only to regroup later in perfect order when the moment was right. The Imperium's tactical doctrines had to be rewritten when dealing with Blood Pact incursions. Standard assumptions about the behavior of Chaos cultists no longer held. These heretics would not simply charge screaming into heavy bolter fire. Though they certainly screamed praises to the Blood God, it was often from behind the cover of a well-placed gun emplacement. They were soldiers first, and madmen second. Despite all the layers of strategy and military precision, at its heart the Blood Pact remained a cult dedicated to chaos and to the war god Khorne. Its culture and traditions were steeped in symbolism meant to constantly remind its warriors of their unbreakable oath and the bloody religion they served. The most visible of these symbols was the appearance of the Blood Pact warriors themselves. To a frightened guardsman peering through the smoke of battle, a Blood Pact assault trooper looked like a ghastly parody of an Imperial soldier. Their basic attire often began as standard Imperial Guard uniforms, flak armor vests, combat fatigues, heavy boots, a steel pot helmet. Because they frequently looted equipment from battlefields or copied Imperial designs on their own profane forges. However, no two Blood Pact soldiers ever looked exactly alike for long. Their gear was scavenged and personalized over time, tunics torn and restitched with crude patches, armor plates adorned with spikes or trophies like finger bones and teeth, helmets dented and scratched from brutal use. The overall impression was one of a rough and barbaric, yet unmistakably martial force. The familiar outline of a guardsman's kit, but twisted into something darker and more feral. Chief among their identifying features was the ritual face, covering each warrior wore the infamous Iron Grotesque. These were heavy metal masks fashioned into horrifying visages, snarling, leering faces with exaggerated hooked noses, fang-like teeth, or horn-like juts. The grotesque served multiple purposes. Practically, it protected the face and further anonymized the wearer, making each trooper look like an interchangeable avatar of chaos. Psychologically, it was meant to inspire fear. To see a line of blood-packed fighters advancing behind identical leering death masks is to face an enemy seemingly stripped of humanity and possessed by war demons. Culturally, the mask was a mark of initiation. Once a man donned the grotesque, his old identity was gone, subsumed entirely into the cult. Most grotesques were a dull black iron or steel dark and soot-stained from constant exposure to smoke and blood. However, a few high-ranking officers were known to wear grotesques decorated in tarnished gold or silver, befitting their status. And rumor held that Archon Urlok Gaur's own faceplate was a fearsome thing wrought in brass and red enamel, fashioned to resemble the snarling countenance of a bloodthirster daemon. Whether myth or fact, such stories only fed the Blood Pact's aura, of demonic menace. The uniforms of the Blood Pact further set them apart. It was not enough to simply wear scavenged armor. It had to be claimed and profaned in the Blood God's name. Thus, almost every article of clothing and armor was dyed or stained a dingy reddish brown, the unmistakable color of dried blood. This was not mere camouflage or uniform regulation, but a sacrament. After a victorious battle, Blood Pact warriors would engage in a grisly ritual, soaking their garments in the fresh blood of the slain. They would dunk tunics and battle standards into barrels brimming with gore, or else simply kneel among the fallen and slather their armor in the pooling blood. By the time it dried to a crust, it left a permanent ruddy hue on fabric and a rusty patina on metal. Layer upon layer of such blood soakings, campaign after campaign, gave veteran fighters an appearance as though they had emerged from a slaughterhouse, and a stench to match. The Blood Pact were known to reek of death. A cloying odor of old blood and offal clung to them, mixed with the acrid tang of cheap unguents and machine oil that they used to anoint their bodies. Hygiene and cleanliness were of no concern. Filth was embraced as another token of devotion, a badge that worldly comforts meant nothing compared to the glory of slaughter. Another hallmark of Blood Pact warriors was that they always bared their hands in combat. Unlike many Imperial troops who wear gloves for protection, Pact fighters went into battle with naked hands, regardless of weather or hazards. This was to display the ritual scars on their palms and knuckles, the permanent testimony of their oath. Every Blood Pact member's initiation involved slicing open his hands on the blades of Gaur's armor, or on a similarly sanctified weapon if inducted in the field. The wounds healed into jagged scars, crisscrossing the palms. To them, these scars were more honorable than any medal, and many continued the practice of self-scarification long after induction. After every particularly glorious victory, warriors might slice new cuts into their flesh, on the arms, across the chest or face, as offerings of pain to Khorne. Over years, a veteran's body could become a lattice of scar tissue. Comrades would look upon a warrior etched with countless scars with reverence and a touch of fear, for each mark was proof of battles survived and devotion renewed. The deeper and more numerous the scars, the greater the perceived devotion to the Blood God's cause. Ritual and belief played a constant role in the Blood Pact's operations. Each squad or company often included one or more warrior priests, veterans who doubled as keepers of the squad's spiritual fervor. Before a battle, these individuals led their comrades in guttural litanies, call and response prayers to Khorne and oaths to Gore. They might stand in a circle, each warrior cutting a minor wound on his forearm to let a few drops of blood fall as offering, while the priest intoned, "Whose blood is this?" And the warriors growled in unison, "Ours, given gladly." Then the priest roared, "For whom do we give it?" And all answered, "For the Gaur and the Blood God." In this way, moments before battle was joined, every Blood Pact fighter was reminded of exactly who and what he was fighting for. These savage catechisms whipped them into a state of controlled frenzy, not the mindless, berserk rage of an untrained cultist, but the focused wrath of a believer who knows that every enemy he kills is an offering upon an altar of war. By the time the order came to attack, they were often chanting, "Blood, blood, blood," in a low, hungry growl, a terrifying sound rising from dozens of vox grills in the fog of war. In battle itself, the war cries of the Blood Pact further set them apart. Over the cacophony of gunfire and explosions, Imperial Guardsmen would hear their guttural howls, "Blood for the Blood God, skulls for Gaur," twisted variations of the classic Khorne battle cry. They invoked the skull throne of Khorne and the name of their Archon in the same breath, an affront to Imperial ears. To the faithful of the Imperium, it was blasphemy, the sacred war cry of the Imperial Guard for the Emperor, inverted by heretics praising a ruinous power and a mortal traitor. But to the Blood Pact, it was the purest expression of their purpose. They gave no quarter and expected none. Surrender was never an option, not for them, and often not for their enemies either, as they routinely butchered captives or used them as blood sacrifices after battle. The Pact waged war as a form of worship, and in their worldview, only those willing to kill or die for their god and leader had any right to live. While their religious fervor and savagery drove them, it was the Blood Pact's tactics and discipline that truly made them infamous on the battlefield. Unlike many Kornite devotees, who favor reckless melee charges and seek only personal martial glory, the Blood Pact recognized the value of strategy and combined arms warfare. They drilled extensively in marksmanship, small unit tactics, and complex maneuvers. A typical Blood Pact trooper went into battle with a well-maintained laser gun or autogun as his primary weapon, and was perfectly willing to gun down enemies from cover or at range. He knew spilling blood from 500 meters with a trigger pull still pleased Khorne if done in the context of war. They laid suppressive fire, coordinated flanking attacks, and executed ambushes with patience and cunning. When fights closed to short range, they showed their true allegiance with acts of tremendous brutality, lobbing strings of barbed grenades into trenches, or storming bunkers with chain axes and serrated combat blades drawn. But even then, it was often done according to a plan, with some squads providing covering fire while others went in to cleave and kill. In claustrophobic environments like urban ruins or tunnel networks, the Blood Pact proved extremely deadly. They often made use of makeshift melee implements ideal for trench warfare, hatchets, spiked maces, sharpened entrenching tools, and brutal trench knives. Many carried lengths of chain or wire to garrot sentries in the dark. They were adept at using the environment to their advantage. For instance, rigging whole building floors to collapse on advancing Imperial troops, or using sewer ducts and access shafts to appear where least expected. Some Blood Pact units cultivated demolition specialists or snipers within their ranks, contrary to the stereotype that Kornate cultists disdain such roles. These specialists would target Imperial artillery emplacements, or pick off enemy officers prior to a main assault, sowing confusion. In short, the Pact did not shy from any method of war that could spill blood efficiently. On defense, they were no less dangerous. A Blood Pact garrison would swiftly fortify positions with booby traps and overlapping fields of fire. Unlike many heretic forces that might break when pressed, Blood Pact defenders held the line with grim resolve, knowing that death in battle was the surest path to Khorne's favor. They executed orderly fighting retreats when needed, trading space for time and dragging out conflicts to bleed the enemy. And always, always, they infused terror into their tactics. It was common, for example, for a blood-packed rearguard to leave grisly displays behind as they fell back. Headless corpses arranged in grotesque tableaus, or flayed skins nailed to bunker walls. Anything to unnerve and delay their pursuers. One cannot discuss Blood Pact tactics without recounting some of their most infamous engagements, as each reveals a facet of their style of warfare. Apart from the ambush at Acherite Peninsula already described, there were countless clashes during the Sabbat World's Crusade, where their prowess was on display. On the acid fog world of Fantine, for example, the Imperium sought to liberate a series of airborne refinery cities from chaos occupation. Elements of the Blood Pact were present as part of the defending enemy forces. During the assault on Sirenholm, one of Fantine's mountaintop settlements, Imperial airborne troops expected a chaotic street fight against disorganized cultists. Instead, they found themselves being lured into well-planned kill zones. Blood-packed units feigned retreat into narrow gantries and alleys, only to draw the pursuing Imperials into crossfires and pre-sighted fields of fire that left hundreds dead. What was supposed to be a hard-fought but straightforward victory turned into a grueling bloodbath. The Blood Pact turned the dense, toxic streets of Sirenholm into killing grounds, mining key approach routes, and sniping from high towers. By battle's end, the Imperial forces did take the city, but at a far higher cost than anticipated. Fantine showed the Imperium that Chaos could field forces capable of acting as efficient soldiers, not merely the mindless fanatics Imperial tacticians had presumed them to be. Veterans of Fantine would later write that the Blood Pact fought as hard and craftily as any ghost, referring to the Tanith first and only, known as Gaunt's Ghosts. And indeed, the Tanith themselves were present and hard-pressed in that campaign. It was on Fantine that the Ghosts first encountered the Blood Pact directly, and both sides gained a grudging respect for the other's stealth and tenacity. Another brutal theater was the battle for Aixe Cardinal, a world whose simmering civil war between Chaos sympathizers and loyalists had drawn in the Crusade. The Blood Pact reinforced the Chaos-affiliated armies on Aix and helped transform the conflict into a nightmare that resembled the trench warfare of ancient Terra. For months, the Imperial Guard and Blood Pact fought from opposing networks of trenches and forts, slogging over muddy, shell-cratered ground under constant rain. The Pact advisors on Aixe Cardinal applied their knowledge of attritional war to deadly effect. They seeded no man's land with barbed wire and trap-filled shell holes, making every meter gained a costly prize. At night, Pact infiltration teams crawled through the mud to cut the throats of Imperial sentries or to plant explosives beneath forward bunkers, terrorizing the soldiers in the trenches. They unleashed chemical weapons, choking gases that lingered heavy in the misty air, disregarding any notion of restraint. In one notorious incident, an Imperial company advancing after an artillery barrage found an apparently abandoned, blood-packed trench line. Cautiously, they moved in, only to discover the trench filled with corpses of enemy soldiers. These bodies had been deliberately booby-trapped with wire-triggered grenades and pressure mines under their uniforms. The moment the Imperial troops tried to clear the trench, the charges went off, ripping men apart in a gory, concussive blast, using the enemy's own dead as shrapnel. Such was the ingenuity of horror the Blood Pact brought to that war. Though Aixe Cardinal was eventually freed from Chaos influence, the campaign lasted long, exhausting months, and cost tens of thousands of lives. Those who survived it spoke of the Blood Pact there with a mix of hatred and unwilling admiration, for they had seen how unyielding and inventive these foes could be, even in the worst conditions. The war in the Sabbat worlds saw the Blood Pact deployed on dozens of worlds, each time adding to their bloody legend. They fought in the burning streets of hive cities, in frozen tundra fields, and in the steaming jungles of forgotten continents. On every battleground, their presence seemed to elevate the conflict's brutality. This was not only due to their own direct actions, but also the fear they instilled. The mere rumor that Blood Pact units were among an enemy host often made Imperial defenders hesitate or overfortify, knowing that these adversaries would not break like ordinary cultists. Young Imperial recruits, hearing such rumors, sometimes quailed and had to be stiffened by commissars. After all, how does one fight an enemy who does not fear death, who in fact craves a death in battle as a holy fulfillment? The only answer the Imperium could give was to meet fanaticism with equal resolve, to fight harder, dig deeper, and pray for the Emperor's guidance. Among the many battles of the Crusade, a few stand out for the Blood Pact's particularly significant role. The Siege of Vervunhiv on Verkhast was one early instance. A chaos warlord named Herator, Asphodel, not of the Blood Pact himself, but allied with the Archon, besieged the loyalist hive city of Vervunhive with an army of traitors. While Asphodel's primary force was a cult from Zoica, it was later discovered that Blood Pact specialists were present as advisors and shock troops. The fall of Vervunhive's outer defenses was marked by tactics that bore the Pact's signature. Coordinated bombardments, followed by disciplined infantry pushes and psychological warfare in the form of mass terror. The attackers used captured Imperial Vox casters to broadcast taunts and horrific sounds into the city at night. They crucified prisoners and raised them on the front lines where the defenders could see their comrades' agony. Though Vervunhive ultimately held out, thanks in part to the intervention of Colonel Commissar Ibram Gaunt and his ghosts, the cost was appalling, and the involvement of the Blood Pact foreshadowed how even more dire battles would become. Perhaps the most pivotal confrontation involving the Blood Pact came on the holy planet of Herador in 773.M41. Herador became the site of a miraculous event, the resurrection of Saint Sabbat, the patron saint of the Crusade. This divine occurrence sent waves of inspiration through the Imperial forces and terrified the Chaos Warlords, who realized that the Imperium's faith had been given a powerful rallying point. In response, Archon Urlok Gore orchestrated a massive counteroffensive to destroy this beacon of hope. The Blood Pact were at the forefront of the assault on Herador's capital. Gar committed some of his finest units, determined to snuff out the reborn saint and demoralize the crusade once and for all. The fighting around Herador's Cathedrum, the grand ecclesiarchal palace, was nightmarish. Blood-packed companies flung themselves at the imperial defensive lines, guarding Saint Sabbat and her retinue. Again and again they charged, not mindlessly but in relentless waves, each one probing for weaknesses. The most feared among them, the legendary Death Brigades, were unleashed here. These Death Brigade units were the Pact's elite veteran soldiers who had survived countless battles and had been honed into remorseless killers. Clad in heavier armor, blood-red carapace plates etched with the eight-pointed star, and often equipped with lethal close-quarter weapons like power axes and flamers, the Death Brigade troopers moved with the coordination of a crack stormtrooper squad and the ferocity of a berserker squad. They spearheaded assaults, leading lesser cultists and chaos creatures in their wake. In the defense of Herador, a handful of Death Brigade teams managed to breach the inner compounds. In one chilling incident, a Death Brigade squad feigned surrender after being surrounded by Royal Volpone Regiment troops and Adepta Sororitas, dropping their weapons and kneeling as if to capitulate. When the Imperial commander hesitated, perhaps stunned that these fanatics might yield, the Pact troopers sprang their trap. Concealed pistols and blades were suddenly drawn, and they lunged at their would-be captors with vicious speed. Dozens of Imperial soldiers were slaughtered in seconds by the duplicitous gambit. Such treachery and audacity exemplified the Blood Pact ethos. There was no honor except victory, no truth but what served chaos. Ultimately, it took the personal intervention of Saint Sabbat herself, according to hagiographic accounts, to turn the tide at Herador. As the Blood Pact closed in on the sanctum, the saint stepped onto the battlefield, a glowing figure of divine light amid the smoke. The sight enraged the Pact forces, who redoubled their efforts to reach her. But the saint's presence emboldened the Imperial defenders to superhuman courage. In the final moments, as legend tells it, Sabbat confronted a champion of the Blood Pact. Some say it was an 8-foot-tall mutant beast on loan from the legions. Others claim it was a Blood Pact colonel in demonically blessed armor. With a blinding swing of her sword, wreathed in holy fire, she struck the champion down. The morale shock of this, a living saint, cutting through their mightiest warrior, caused the blood-packed assault to falter. Imperial reinforcements surged in, and what had been a near-chaos victory turned into a rout. The blood-packed, many of them unwilling to retreat, were cut down almost to a man in the city's plazas and halls. Herodor remained in imperial hands, and the saint lived, shining as a symbol of the emperor's grace. For the blood-packed, Herodor was a bitter failure. They had come within a blade's width of extinguishing the Imperium's new hope, yet ultimately were driven off. Still, their role in that battle solidified their reputation as the Imperium's most dreaded human foes, for it was noted that even in the face of a miracle, the blood pact did not break until they were literally slaughtered to the last. Through all these battles, a pattern emerged. The blood pact often found themselves in bitter opposition against one particular band of Imperial soldiers. The Tanith first and only, Colonel Commissar Gaunt's regiment. Time and again, on Fantine, on Ixe Cardinal, on Herodor and beyond, Gaunt's stealthy ghosts clashed with blood-packed forces, and a fierce mutual enmity took root. The Tanith, being masters of camouflage and reconnaissance, discovered that the blood-packed could nearly match them in stealth and cunning, a sobering realization for the proud scouts. On the other side, the Blood Pact recognized the Tanith by their trademark camo cloaks and deadly sharpshooting, and came to view them as a nemesis to be exterminated at all costs. It became a grudge match amidst the greater war. Blood Pact officers would snarl orders to target the Shadowborn whenever the Tanith were identified on the field, hoping to erase the embarrassment of being foiled by mere humans. Meanwhile, Gaunt's men took grim satisfaction in thwarting the Pact's plans, and even assassinating some of their leaders. Indeed, one of Gaur's favored lieutenants, Sagittar Slaeth, a fearsome Blood Pact commander, met his end at the hands of Gaunt in a duel amidst the trench hell of Aix Sa-Cardinal. Such episodes only fueled the hatred. The Blood Pact began to single out the Tanith for special horrors, such as flaying captured ghosts alive or sending taunting messages over Vox addressed to Gaunt personally. The Tanith, in turn, learned to strike first and hard whenever blood-packed war banners were sighted, denying them the chance to employ their guile. The rivalry became the stuff of war legend, an ironic mirror image of the eternal struggle. A small, elite Imperial unit versus the elite of Chaos, each the bane of the other. This rivalry came to a head dramatically on the desert world of Jago, at the fortress Hinzer House, during the later stages of the Crusade. The Tanith first and only, and a few allied regiments, were assigned to hold this isolated mountain citadel to protect the Crusade's flank. The Blood Pact, determined to crush their hated foes, descended in force. What followed was the Siege of Hinzer House, a desperate, close-fought affair that tested both sides to the limit. The Pact invested the fortress with thousands of troops. They arrived under cover of a dust storm and immediately cut off all communication lines surrounding the mountain. Inside Hinzer House's thick walls, Gaunt's men and their comrades prepared as best they could, planting mines and setting up overlapping fields of fire. But the blood-packed siege was methodical. They bombarded the fortress with captured Imperial artillery from just beyond the reach of return fire, hammering the defenses day and night. Then, under the cover of those shellings or the dead of night, they launched probing assaults at the gates, the lower bastions. Even the cliffside approaches thought impassable. The Tanith and their allies repelled these, but each time at mounting cost. The Blood Pact showed no concern for losses. They would press an attack until it nearly succeeded or clearly failed, and if it failed, they only pulled back to regroup and try again, hours later. One night, Under faint moonlight and blowing sand, blood-packed commandos managed to scale a sheer cliff at the fortress's rear, an approach deemed impossible. Using climbing claws and sheer determination, a team of a dozen elite packed soldiers infiltrated through a drainage duct and burst into the heart of the fortress, guns blazing. In the chaos that followed, Colonel Commissar Gaunt was gravely wounded and captured by the raiders. The blood-packed commandos dragged him, bleeding but alive, out through their escape route before the Tanith even realized he was gone. Gaunt's capture was a triumph for the Pact. They had snared the Imperium's beloved Ghostmaker himself, and they swiftly spirited him to a makeshift prison camp in the Badlands. However, the ghosts were nothing if not tenacious. Enraged by the loss of their commander, the Tanith launched a daring rescue operation behind enemy lines the very next day, even as Hinzerhaus remained under siege. A small team slipped out of the fortress through old catacombs, navigated the desert, and assaulted the Pact camp at dusk. In a vicious close-quarters fight, they overpowered the guards and retrieved Gaunt, who, though injured, managed to kill his interrogator and free other prisoners in the fray. The rescuers and their reclaimed colonel then trekked back to friendly lines under cover of darkness. Not long after, relief finally arrived on Jago. A massive Imperial counterattack forced the blood-packed besiegers to lift their siege and withdraw or face encirclement. The Tanith held Hinzerhaus barely. The fortress was shattered, its halls filled with the dead and dying. But they had withstood the best the Blood Pact threw at them, and that was no small feat. In the aftermath, it was said that the Blood Pact considered the Tanith uncanny ghosts that refused to die, while the Tanith considered the Blood Pact their most implacable adversary. Each had tempered the other in the fires of war. While the Blood Pact waged unholy war against the Imperium, a dangerous subplot was unfolding within the forces of Chaos themselves, one that would eventually implode and weaken their effort. Archon Urlok Gaur's meteoric rise to power had not sat well with all of his peers. The most notable malcontent was his erstwhile subordinate, Magister Anaquanar Sik. Sik, a brilliant but deceitful Chaos warlord, had bent the knee to Gaur after Nazibar's death, but in his heart he seethed. By Sik's reckoning, he was the more cunning commander and the more favored of the Dark Gods. Only Gaur's possession of the Blood Pact had robbed Sik of the title of Archon. And so, in secret, Sik plotted to do what Gaur had done, to create his own elite army and eventually supplant his master. In secret, under Sik's direction, a new Chaos warband began to take shape during the Crusade. The Sons of Sik. Modeled closely on the Blood Pact, the Sons were Sik's bid to build a rival disciplined legion. He established training camps on the occupied world of Geryon, hidden from Gaur's oversight. There, Sik gathered fanatical recruits from the Sanguinary Worlds, regions fervently devoted to Chaos, and drilled them hard. He even lured away a prize defector, Mab'on Etogor, a high-ranking Blood Pact officer who betrayed Gaur to assist Sik. With Mab'on's insider knowledge of the Pact's organization, Sik was able to mirror and refine Gaur's methods. The Sons of Sik were taught to fight with the same rigor as the Blood Pact. They even introduced their own version of commissar-like enforcers called Scourgers, men armed with barbed whips, who drove Sik's troops onward and punished any lapse in zeal. Sik enhanced his army's loyalty through a mix of technological and sorceress indoctrination, a concept he called the voice which drowns out all others. Through hypnosis, psychoconditioning, and perhaps chaos sorcery, Sik implanted in his followers' minds a singular devotion to his commands, the voice. This made the Sons of Sik frighteningly zealous and immune to fear, even beyond the norm for Chaos cultists. At first, the Sons of Sik operated as part of the larger Chaos host, fighting the Imperium alongside the Blood Pact and other warbands. Imperial forces who encountered them reported that these new enemies were as disciplined and vicious as the Blood Pact, if not more so, which was saying something. But in the shadows, Sick was preparing to make his move. His ultimate plan was to use the Sons of Sick to eliminate Urlok Garr and take the title of Archon for himself. However, the alliance between Garr and Sick was destined to fracture before Sick could betray him on his own terms. A catalyst arrived in the form of a daring Imperial strike in 781 M41. Colonel Commissar Gaunt and a hand-picked team of ghosts embarked on a covert mission deep behind enemy lines, attacking a secret Chaos space station and research facility known as Salvation's Reach. This raid succeeded in destroying valuable assets and sowing confusion among the Chaos leadership. In the aftermath, trust between Garr and Sick, never strong, collapsed entirely. Each accused the other, privately, of negligence or treachery that allowed the Imperials to get so far. Sick saw the moment to act and began openly pulling his forces back from Gower's commands, essentially declaring an undeclared rebellion. By the early 780s, M41, open war erupted between the Sons of Sick and the Blood Pact. Instead of a unified arch-enemy front, there were now two rival Chaos armies in the Sabbat worlds, each led by a would-be Archon. The Blood Pact remained loyal to Urlok Garr, while the Sons of Sick rallied to Anaquanar Sick's banner. Sick took to calling himself the Anarch by now, a title signifying his aspiration to unseat Garr. The Imperium, initially perplexed by reports of Chaos-on-Chaos battles, soon recognized an opportunity. Warmaster Makaroth and his staff began to exploit the enemy's civil war, pressing offensives precisely when and where the Blood Pact and Sons of Sick were at each other's throats. The internecine conflict reached a climax on the strategically crucial Forge world of Urdesh around 792 M41. Urdesh, with its gargantuan factories and mines, had been under Blood Pact control and was a jewel in Gower's domain, vital for supplying his armies. Sick coveted it both as a resource trove and as a symbolic capital from which to claim overall leadership. Thus, as Imperial armies launched a major campaign to retake Urdesh, the Sons of Sick also struck, turning the planet into a three-way battleground. Blood Pact forces defending Urdesh suddenly found themselves fighting not only Imperial Guardsmen and Space Marines, but also their supposed allies, the Sons, who infiltrated and sabotaged from within. Amidst the orbital strikes and city ruins firefights of Urdesh, legend holds that Anaquanar Sick and Urlok Garr finally confronted each other, if not in person, then army to army. The Sons of Sick fought with fanatical courage, some driven to a frenzy by the voice Sick had instilled in them, while the Blood Pact fought with their trademark discipline and wrath at the betrayal. The Imperials, for their part, pushed hard to annihilate both traitor forces. In the cauldron of this battle, destiny tipped. The accounts vary on exactly how Sick met his end. One story says that a team of Adeptus Astartes from the Iron Snakes chapter cut through Sick's elite guard and shot the Anarch dead at the climax of the siege. Another tale insists that Sick and a bodyguard of his sons were cornered by a vengeful pack of blood-packed death brigadiers in the Manufactorum district. The ensuing melee left Sick decapitated by a chain axe swing and his body nailed to a factory wall as a grisly trophy. A more miraculous version tells that Sick was struck down by a hidden son of Garion, possibly a turncoat he had wronged, guided by the spirit of Saint Sabbat. The exact truth may never be known, but one thing is certain. Anaquanar Sick was slain during the Urdesh campaign. In that moment, every son of Sick who had been psychically bound to his voice recoiled in agony. Some were driven insane by the psychic backlash of their master's death. Others simply dropped dead on the spot, as if their strings had been cut. The death of Sick was a decisive turning point. The Sons of Sick, deprived of their founder and unifying voice, fragmented. Many of those who survived attempted to flee Urdesh and the Sabbat worlds, retreating rimward to avoid Gower's vengeance and the Imperial Hammer. A few die-hard factions of the Sons remained, temporarily led by surviving commanders who squabbled amongst themselves. In time, one of six lieutenants claimed to receive a new voice from the Darkies and tried to rally the survivors. But by then, the Sons of Sik were a spent force, torn by internal strife and hunted mercilessly by both Blood Pact retributors and Imperial pursuers. Urlok Garr's Blood Pact had emerged battered but intact. The attempted coup had failed. By the latter years of the Sabbat World's Crusade, the Blood Pact had been beaten back on many fronts. World after world was liberated by the Imperium's inexorable advance. The loss of Sik and the internal chaos civil war had weakened the archenemy position irreparably. The Imperials pressed the advantage. The final campaigns of the Crusade saw the Blood Pact making last stands on worlds like Ancreon Sextus and Garapan, fighting ferociously but ultimately unable to halt the Imperial momentum. Archon Urlok Garr himself vanished from the forefront of events as the walls closed in. Some believe he was critically wounded in a bombardment and carried off by his followers. Others suggest he retreated into the warp, biding his time. A persistent rumor claims Garr never forgave Sik's treachery, and even as the Imperium closed on him, he led a contingent of blood-packed survivors into the Eye of Terror rather than give the loyalists the satisfaction of slaying him. No confirmed record of Garr's death exists in Imperial archives. Regardless, by the formal end of the Crusade, circa mid-790s M41, the Blood Pact as a unified army was shattered. Many thousands of them had been killed over the course of the war. Others splintered into rogue warbands and went to ground, hiding on remote worlds or fleeing into the warp storms that occasionally beset the sector. The Imperium declared victory and celebrated the liberation of the Sabbat worlds, though at a staggering cost in blood and treasure. However, the legacy of the Blood Pact did not simply vanish with their battlefield defeat. The horror they had inflicted and the example they set left an indelible mark on the Imperium and on the very way the Imperial Guard viewed its enemies. The name Blood Pact itself became synonymous with the worst that human treachery could produce. Imperial commanders who had faced them wrote extensive after-action reports analyzing the Pact's tactics, equipment, and psychology. Their findings were compiled into military journals and tactical primers for future generations. No longer would the Astra Militarum assume that chaos warbands were automatically disorganized or poorly led. The Blood Pact had proven that under the right leadership, even a cult of the Dark Gods could rival the best of the Emperor's armies in discipline and skill. This realization led to changes in training and doctrine. New simulated exercises were introduced to prepare guardsmen for fighting foes who employed Imperial-like tactics, and commissars redoubled efforts to instill unshakable faith so that troopers would not falter when confronted with the Pact's brand of terror. In the halls of Imperial history, the Blood Pact holds a dark but important place. They are cited both as a cautionary tale and a grudging example of the enemy's capability. The cautionary aspect is clear. Here were men and women of humanity, not aliens or monsters, who through corruption and ritual became arguably as formidable as the Emperor's own soldiers. It underscored the ever-present risk of heresy within the Imperium's ranks. The Blood Pact had actively recruited from traitorous guard units and disaffected populations. Their existence revealed how quickly the rot of chaos could take hold and turn the weapons of mankind against itself. Many a sermon by the Ecclesiarchy in the wake of the Crusade reminded the faithful that the Blood Pact's atrocities were committed by human hands, a stark warning that any soul can fall if faith weakens. Yet, alongside the horror, some Imperial tacticians could not help but hold a begrudging respect for the Blood Pact's martial prowess. It is not admiration in a positive sense, but an acknowledgement of a hard truth. The Imperium must always be ready to face its mirror image in the form of disciplined heretical armies. In some ways, the Blood Pact forced the Imperium to better itself. Complacency was no longer an option. As one Lord Militant put it, they taught us the price of underestimating the heretic. We shall not make that mistake again. For the people of the Sabbat worlds, the memory of the Blood Pact remains a living nightmare, even years after liberation. The scars on cities and mines do not heal easily. There are planets where the ruins of towns still bear the crude crimson graffiti of the Pact's occupation, and people refuse to live there, saying the place still smells of blood. Veterans who fought them wake in the night at times, imagining they hear the scrape of an iron grotesque mask in the dark, or the distant echo of a frenzied war cry. Parents tell unruly children that if they don't behave, the Blood Pact will come for them out of the shadows. A hyperbolic threat, but one born of genuine fear that lingers in cultural memory. In countless reconsecration ceremonies, imperial priests have had to cleanse profaned sites where the Pact performed their sacrileges. Mass graves of their victims, uncovered after the war, stand as solemn monuments to the cruelty that was unleashed. In the end, the story of the Blood Pact in the Sabbat World's Crusade is one of the darkest chapters of that conflict, a chapter written in blood and nightmares. It serves as a grim reminder that the forces of chaos are not limited to incoherent mobs or the superhuman traitor marines. They can manifest as disciplined legions of men, perverting the very ideals of soldiering to serve the dark gods. The Blood Pact showed that faith and fanaticism, when married to training and strategy, can pose a threat of an entirely new magnitude. They were arguably the purest distillation of chaos in human form. Utterly evil, utterly relentless, yet disturbingly orderly in their pursuit of destruction. Millions perished at their hands, from the grimmest battlefields to the humblest of villages put to the sword as object lessons in terror. Entire imperial regiments were ground to nothing facing them. Worlds were left depopulated or in ruins after their passing. Their rise and fall influenced the very course of the Sabbat World's Crusade, nearly tipping the balance to chaos on several occasions. Thus, with cautious relief and lingering dread, the Imperium remembers the Blood Pact. Their creed of blood and discipline took humanity to the brink of a new dark age in the Sabbat worlds. Their blood-red armor and grotesque iron masks remain enduring symbols of fear images that will haunt the Imperial psyche for generations. And though the Blood Pact was broken as an army, small remnants and copycats still fester in the galaxy's wound. Even now, a decade or two later, Imperial patrols sometimes report encounters with bandits or raiders who bear the scars and red gear of the Pact. These stragglers, leaderless and scattered, lack the might they once had, but they fight on with the same malignant resolve, like embers of a fire that refuse to go cold. The Inquisition diligently hunts them, stamping out these embers wherever found, wary that given the slightest oxygen, the fire could ignite again. The legacy of the Blood Pact is a warning etched in blood, that humanity's own can become the sharpest blade against it when corrupted by chaos. It is also a testament to the fact that even in a galaxy of tyrants and monsters, the defiance and unity of the Imperium symbolized by heroes like the Tanith and Saint Sabbat can overcome the foulest of foes. But the Imperium will not soon forget the elite warriors of Archon Urlok Gar. The story of the Blood Pact will be told for centuries in drill yards and strategium briefings, a tale to steal the spine of every guardsman who might one day face the unenviable task of fighting an enemy that is, in effect, a dark reflection of themselves. In the grim darkness of the far future, the Blood Pact stands as one of the most chilling examples of how war and corruption can twist men into something both familiar and utterly heinous. An object lesson in the truth that the only thing more terrifying than a horde of madmen is a horde of madmen that marches as if guided by a single malevolent will. The galaxy will remember the Blood Pact and shudder.